Loneliness. Loneliness is the food of the person going through the dark hour of the soul. I mean, there is nothing that will make us feel more isolated and alone than pain, than grief, than sorrow. It's like we're on this little sandy, small island in the middle of the ocean, and this is our island. This is our experience. This is what has happened to me. This is what I have lost. This is the bitter drink that I am drinking. This is my real estate. It's not your real estate. It's my real estate. And I'm here and I'm trapped here. Loneliness is what so often is the number one feeling that people in grief and loss and pain experience. It's a conflicted thing because in the midst of this, you have feelings that don't come together. At once you want what you have been through to be seen. You want it validated. You want it understood. You want people to appreciate what you have experienced. But at the same time, you don't want anybody to see you like this. You want people to come to you and be with you. But the minute they're there, you just want them to go away. You have this deep desire to have questions answered, but don't you dare try to answer my questions. This is the experience of grief. This is what makes it such a challenge to try to be a friend of a person living on that island, to be a friend to the person who is in that season where what was certain is now completely uncertain. What was counted on has been lost. What was the way it has always been is now no longer the way it will ever be again. This person who has had all their certainty thrown out the window, how do you be a friend to that person? It's a scary thing because very often getting close to their pain reminds you of your pain, and maybe you haven't been equipped or dealt adequately with your pain, and so to feel it makes you feel just uncertain. And you don't know what to say, and you want so powerfully to say the right thing and express the right thing. And you don't know what to do. If you could do it, you would do it. You would buy it. You would send it. You would assist it. You would rally troops to do it. But what if there's nothing to do? What if there's nothing you can say? How awkward is that going to be? You know, one of the most profound human experiences that make us connectedness, that's the key to community, is this thing called empathy. And what empathy is it's my pain being felt through you. That is to say, it's actually traced in the brain that when we have a painful experience, it creates a pathway of memory in our brain. And then when we see you going through something, that makes us walk down that path again. And if we have not walked down that path again, then your pain is exceptionally unsettling. So very often to be a friend, what we deeply desire is to make you feel better, not even so much so that you can feel better, but so that I can feel better. We would love for you to be able to have what you need to move on, not so much so you can move on, but so that I can move on. We'd love you to find some clarity and some certainty about your situation so I could be comfortable in the clarity and the certainty of the situation that I have that I'm not sure I should have. This is the book of Job. This is the book that speaks to the most human condition that all of us in some way, at some level, will experience, a dark hour of the soul where we will taste loss. We will drink deeply from the cup of disappointment. We will experience grief in this life. And so this book, the oldest book in the Bible, could not be more relevant than it is for us today. This is what we've been saying about the book of Job. We've been saying that Job is a book of wisdom, and it's so important to understand that this is a book of wisdom. This is not a book of rules or laws or self-help. This is not even a theological treatise about why bad things happen. This is a book of wisdom, and wisdom is different than rules. Wisdom is the kind of thing where you have the principles of God that are held here, and then under the leadership of the Holy Spirit, you just understand how to apply them to a specific situation. Now, a rule is different. A rule is the thing you do in every time in every situation. And one of the things we're going to learn, particularly about Job's friends, the people who came to him during his dark hour of the soul, is that they were confusing rules with wisdom. They were misapplying and misusing the truth of God and the truth of God's word, very much like a novice pretend wannabe construction person might use a saw that he's never turned on before. And it can do a lot of damage, and it doesn't do a lot of good cuts. So Job is a book of wisdom that helps us grapple. And that's a chosen word to say that this is a wrestling, this is a process, this is a painful, and at times it feels spiritually and emotionally and mentally and in every way a life and death struggle to make sense of what I'm experiencing. This is the kind of thing that throws us off our certainty and brings us to the point where it just feels like we're isolated in the middle of the ocean. We grapple with questions of meaning. What does this mean that I've been through? What does it mean about God? What does it mean about me? What does it mean about what I can count on, what I can't count on? Everything has changed. What does that mean? The things that I just assumed, I thought, I just always believed, I didn't even know I believed them, but now I don't even know that I believed them. It's questions of meaning in a world that is filled with true and profound suffering and loss. And never have we been more aware of that. One of the things that we're not aware of is just how much more the tragedy of humanity is laid at our doorstep every day. I mean, today, at this moment, there could be an earthquake, a terrible earthquake, worst earthquake ever happened on the other side of the world, and we would know about it in 10 minutes. It would be on our phones, and we'd see pictures in color of the worst human experience. And we need to make sense of that. Not only that, it comes to our door. How do we make sense of the diagnosis we didn't expect, the job loss we didn't express, the relationship that ended, the child who did what and is where and how? How do we make sense of that? Well, Job speaks to that. Now, we've been saying that there's three paths that Job could walk. We talked about the path of despair. I do want to clarify something about this. This path of despair is when you give up on God, you give up on hope, you just embrace self-destructive behaviors, you become harsh and cynical and embittered. It's a long-term thing. The thing that's interesting is that when you read some of Job's words, it looks like he's walking down that path, but he's not. The difference between what Job does and the path of despair is this. When Job is saying what he's saying it, he's expressing it, and he's doing it in such a way that he's using an ancient biblical form of worship called lament or complaint. That is to say that he so believes that God is there and he is ultimately good and he's got some kind of a plan and he's going to receive this from me that I can be as real and gut-wrenching and honest with him as I need to be. And I do that in experience of faith. That is faith. That's not the absence of faith. That is trust, trusting that God can handle that and he'll meet me in that somehow. That's lament. It was the beautiful message that Pastor Brian preached last week. And so the path of despair is when you give up on that, when you deny it, when you medicate it, when you embrace cynicism and doubt, and you give yourself over to brokenness to cope. Now, the second path is simple answers to mystery, and that's what we're going to talk about today. The friends who come to Job turns out to be really lousy friends. Friends who don't know how to come alongside a person who is in the dark hour of the soul. And it's going to seem that they're talking to Job, but I would just like to suggest to you that the people that Job's friends are talking to is themselves. They are speaking to their own insecurities. They are speaking to their own doubts. They are speaking to how their own certainty is being challenged. Let me say something about that word certainty I keep using, because a lot of people think that certainty and faith are the same thing. They're not. Certainty is this inflexibility that this is the way it is, I'm certain about it, and nothing you're going to say is going to knock me off of that. Faith is what happens when you lose certainty. When I don't know what to do, and I don't know what's going on, and I don't know who you are, God, yet I'm going to still pursue you. That is the most profound faith. And very often we will be defending certainty, thinking we're defending faith, but we're not at all. And what happens to Job's friends is they see what happens to Job, and they have very simple, linear, one-dimensional answers to very complex problems, and they seek to apply it in their situation so that they can apply it to their situation. It's amazing how often when we try to help people, it's actually about us and not about them. Again, we want them to feel better so we can feel better. We'd love for them to move on so we can get back to our life. We'd like them to find answers that they can be certain about so we can run back to the simplistic answers that we have. Indeed, one of the reasons that God brings difficulties in our life is to knock us off our certainty. Here's one of the big lessons of Job. We think in the dark hour of the soul, what we want is answers. And so we ask questions and we want to know why, and we push into that. We think we want answers. But what God understands is that what we really want in the deepest part of our soul is not answers. We want God. And we meet God in the mystery. That's why this thing of lament is so important. This is what Job's friends don't get. Third thing, we're going to see this deeply next week, is the third path is wonder, worship, and a deeper meaning than we could ever understand in the wisdom of God. So let's talk about this. This is the invitation, that there is a God of mystery that is bigger than any pain, loss, and suffering. This is miles away from anything that Job's friends can understand. And because of that, it stirs up in them deep insecurity. And from that insecurity, they become quite abusive to Job. Now, here's the interesting thing about Job's friends. They have a good start. In fact, if all we had in the Bible is what it said in these five or six verses at the beginning of this interaction with Job's friends, this would be like a clinic in how to be a friend to people who are hurting. This would be a clinic on what you do. They have a very good start. Let's take a look. It said, now when Job's three friends heard all this, the evil that had come upon them, that this is something that happened to him. It's not something that he did. It's something that happened to him, okay? And they came, each from his own place. Ilphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shunite, Zophar the Namathite, and baby names, anybody? There's some options there. Anyway, they made an appointment together to come, look at this, and show sympathy and comfort to him. They came to come and to feel his pain. To have sympathy or to have empathy is to feel the pain of another, to share in it, and to bring comfort to it. And again, this so often is where we start. It's amazing how many people have a good start, but they phase out in the end. They want to bring comfort as long as the person makes progress pretty quick. Okay, now watch this though. These friends still, they do even better. And when they saw him from a distance, look at this, they did not even recognize him. They just saw, what happened to this dude? I mean, one of the things that you see as you read through the best of Job, and one of the things that the friends described is that, Job, you used to be the man. You used to be the one that people came to for advice. You were the wise one. You were the together one. You were the example we all cited. People would say, well, what should a great person be? Well, you should be like Job. Look at the success. Look at how he has it together. Look at the wisdom. Look at the integrity. Look at the character. Now, we don't even recognize you. And listen, when we see that happen, especially to someone who has it all together, that is stunningly unsettling. When one of our heroes goes down, when one of the people we thought had it all together, turns out they're as human as the rest of us, deeply unsettling, and they're not aware of what they're feeling in that. And so when you get close to another person's pain, it not only brings you back to your pain, but it unsettles you. And understand, historically, the Church of Jesus Christ has not done this very well, which is amazing because the Bible's full of it. The Church of Jesus Christ has not taught us how to do things like make sense of grief and suffering, how to express it in a healthy way, how to build communities where there's a high degree of patience for people who go through difficult times, when there's an incredible amount of empathy that understands that one of the reasons God gives me pain is so that I can enter into your pain. I can feel some of what you're feeling. I can't get on your island, but I can bring a boat up and I can call from shore because it is your journey, it is your suffering, and I should never pretend that your story is my story. But in the midst of it, the humanity is made through that kind of connection, and that's what these guys want to do. Historically, the church has not done that. That's why we do the emotionally healthy stuff. Because those of you who have been through it, you know one of the big things is making sense of pain and suffering. What happens when you come up against a wall? This is what Trauma Reboot is all about. Doing the counterintuitive work of getting close to your pain, learning to understand it, grieve it, express it, share it in safe community so that it's something that God can transform and use. It becomes a powerful thing. This is stuff they did not understand. They do not recognize him. They don't recognize what's happening to them because of what they're seeing. and they raised their voices and they wept. And this is beautiful, actually. They tore their robes. They sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. They entered into his grief. They acknowledged his grief. They shared his grief. At this point, they're really, really good friends. And they sat with him, watch this, on the ground for 7 days and seven nights. So that's not only like a week, that's also a picture of perspective and imperfection, that perfect number of seven. So they're there, they're going through it, and they don't say a thing. And look at this, no one spoke a word to him, which is just very often all we can do. I mean, I'm a pastor, so people come to me when things have fallen apart. And one of the questions I get asked routinely at these times is, Pastor Paul, why is this happening? And you know what I say? I say, I have no idea. I don't understand. I don't understand. And I hug them and I ask if I can pray with them and I listen to them and I ask them questions. And half the time I fumble and I don't know what to say and it's awkward. My heart's beating fast because all I see is this pain here and I know there's nothing I can do to make it go away, nothing I can do to fix it. There's nothing I can do and no question I can answer, but that I can just bring God into it through presence. So they say nothing, for they saw his suffering was very great. These were great friends until they opened their mouths. When they started talking, things went downhill. So what happens right after this is the passage that Pastor Brian walked us through last week. This passage about lament, this passage about Job just finally saying, where he's at the point where he can say something, he can express something, and he directs a prayer towards God. This prayer of lament, this prayer of complaint. And some of you have brought up with a theology that it's wrong to complain to God. It is actually one of the highest forms of worship. It's going to God and saying, God, I know you're good, but this doesn't seem like you're good. God, I know you got a plan, but right now your plan sucks. God, you know what? I know your love, and you say you love me, and I guess I believe that, but this doesn't feel like love. But because I believe you are good, you have a plan, and you do love me, I'm gonna trust you can handle this. And that's worship. That's the kind of worship and trust that is the highest form of worship. I mean, gratitude is great when things are going great and we say thanks, and that's a really important kind of worship. Another sermon, another day. But I think the kind of worship that is defining is the worship that says, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. In the midst of all this. So Job starts unloading. And this prayer he gave last week, it's a little unnerving. He said, you know what? May the day of my birth be remembered no more. I wish I would have been stillborn. I wish I would have never been born. Why am I still alive? I don't want to be alive. I don't want to face this and taste this. And it would have been better if he would have killed me. You know, I don't know. I 12 years ago or so, a little longer than that, I went through a dark hour of the soul. And I never reached the point where I actively wanted to end my life. But I did reach a point where I understood why people did. And I became afraid of it. And I didn't go over the cliff, but I'll tell you what, there were times I went and I peered over the edge of it. That dark hour of the soul, that I don't know what's gonna happen, but if this is what's left of my life, there's a despair to it. There's a feeling to it. And Job, rather than denying it or pushing it, he expresses it. And it's received by God. Well, it's more than his friends can take. And so each one of them starts responding to God, responding to Job. And understand, their response has more to do with what's going on inside of them, that they're uncomfortable, they want to fix something they can't fix, they're not in control, their theology, not just Job's, but their theology is being blown up. Their childish, simplistic theology, listen now, is inadequate to face the evil and the malevolence of this life. That the theology was not gonna cover it. It wasn't that significant enough. It was too simplistic. And so they can't handle that. And so at first, Job's response makes them afraid because they gotta start questioning things, okay? It's making them feel things they're not equipped or mature enough to feel, okay? And once they become afraid, they quickly move to anger. And it starts by coming out with accusation and blame and simple answers. And then they start attacking his character and they start attacking who they are. Watch this. So first friend, And this is the language, okay? These are basically the four messages they're giving. There's others, but these are the heart of it. The first one is saying, don't feel that way. Job, don't feel that. When we say this to people in ways we don't even realize all the time, I used to do this to my kids all the time. They'd come home, be talking about another kid or a teacher that wasn't good. And I'd, in essence, say, oh, don't feel that way. This is how you should look at that. And this is how we can fix it. And this is how you should understand it. Okay? So don't feel that way. And all they really wanted me to do is say, tell me how you feel. I can appreciate how you feel that way. That must be very frustrating. So that you allow them to feel. Here's the truth about how people feel. People have almost no control over it. And so the way you get how you feel under control is not denying it or not being shamed for feeling that way, but rather learning to express it in a healthy way. And when I started doing that with my kids, they'd talk themselves into a good place. They say, yeah, but it's all right. And that teacher this way. And then they come back around when they have the freedom just to overstate, particularly when you're young, what you're feeling. So we tell people don't feel that way. They tell that to Job. It could be worse. You know, they come and say, you know what, Job? I know this thing happened where you lost four of your kids. I knew a person who lost five. And here's their story on Facebook. I'm sure this will help. Okay, I know you lost your job, you know, but, you know, I went through something, you know, much worse. Let me tell you about my island, okay? And let me step on your island and just assume that your island is the same as my island, okay? And I'm just going to tell you my story before I even hear your story, okay? Because it could have been worse, Job, okay? They're going to also say, and this is the big one, shame on you, Job. The things you're saying, the things you're feeling, how long this is taking you. You know, there are other people who've gone through way worse and they've handled a lot better. What's your deal? Do you not have faith in God? Shame on you. You know, we've got a phrase that's really common right now that is a narrative of shame, and people use it all the time. It's this thing you see after someone does a rant on Facebook or someone says something, you know, this big thing that's wrong and this is what I think we should do and this is terrible and the church didn't or people didn't or government didn't or something. And then at the end it says, and we, you know what? You know, this is terrible. And this is the statement, do better. Have you heard that? You know what? You should do this. Do better. You know, do it. You know what that is? Just saying, shame on you. We need to quit telling people that do better because it's our just way of indignantly saying, shame on you. Now there's another thing they must say, that I must defend God. Because Job's saying some radical things, some scary things that are challenging their theology. And very often we feel like when people are challenging their theology, they're challenging God. They're not challenging God. They're challenging our view of God, which is a completely legitimate thing to do. Your kids, your friends, people. People come up to me and they apologize. Pastor, I have a question about your sermon. I'm not sure I agree. Is that okay? Yes! More than okay. Way to go. Where's the rest of you? I say things wrong all the time. Should be a line around the block of people correcting the goofy things I say. And here you come, and that's a good thing. And the idea that they just say, you know what, Job, you've really made me nervous, and you've challenged my simplistic theology, my very linear and small view of God, and that's making me feel very uncertain, and my certainty is being lost, and I don't have faith to replace the certainty. Did you just hear what I said? I don't have faith to replace the certainty, so I got to attack you to get my certainty back. And so that's what Job's friends are doing. So let's take a look. First friend, Eliphaz, again, baby name. If one ventures a word with you, he says, will you be impatient? So he puts it on Job, says, the problem here, we're not making progress, Joel, okay, is you're not open to criticism. You're not open to, listen, you all are critical. I have constructive criticism. That's because I'm, do better. All right, so that's the thing. All right, will you be impatient? Okay, I just assume the problem's you, Job. Yet who can keep from speaking? Well, you could, Eliphaz. You could just shut up. You could just recognize that you don't have an answer. You don't really know what you're talking about, but you feel this pressure to fix it or to adjust it. And it really is things driving in you. You can't feel better till he feels better. You can't move on with your simple answers unless he accepts the simple answers. And so it's working up in you. Who could keep from speaking? Well, you could. You could, and we could. And so often, that's exactly what we need to do. Remember, who, and then this is what he says. Now, this is what you need to remember. This is something I know you know. I'm just going to remind you, okay? Who was it ever innocent that perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. So this Job, let me just say it. Something bad happened. And that means either God's bad or you did something bad. That's my theology. It's this exact retribution kind of thing. And this is who I think God is. This is think how the world works. This is why I think there's bad things. It's really simple kind of thing. And God's not bad, Job, so you're bad. You are reaping in some way what you sow. Now that thing, reap what you sow, is a biblical principle, but it's a proverb. It's a proverbial statement of wisdom that takes wisdom to know when to apply it. He has made it a rule that every time something bad happens, it is a harvest of some bad thing you're doing, okay? And some of you live on that narrative. You are forever. You know, for some of you, nobody's saying do better, shame on you, to you, except you. And so the biggest critic, the biggest shame merchant you have is the one who lives inside your head. And so for you to get a better theology about the way God is and how you could change that would change everything. Now, some of you just heard what I said and you're going, you're right, I'm terrible, I got to do better. No! Okay? It's a totally different way. And this is the theology that's just inadequate. Okay? Bildad, here's another one. Second friend. How long will you say these things? You can't say that, Job. You can't talk like that. You can't think like that. You can't express like that. What are you doing? You're better than that. Be better. Do better. And the words of your mouth be a great wind. You're just spouting foolishness. And listen, in grief, we spout a lot of foolishness. We overstate things. We say things we don't mean. We're full of exaggeration, hyperbole. We're just throwing out what we feel. Okay, it's a song, it's a poem, it's a rant, it's a lament, it's a complaint, and it's completely legitimate. It's one of the purest forms of worship. And so he's saying, you can't say that, you big windbag. Does God pervert justice? What are you saying about God? Does the Almighty pervert the right? And Job never said anything like that. He's just questioning. He's not saying, God, I don't think you're right, I don't think you're just. He's saying, I've always believed you're right and just, but this is happening, and it doesn't seem right or just. What's with that? And I just want you to answer me, God, okay? I just want you to answer me. And Job thinks he wants answers. He wants something else. Watch this. Did I move forward? All right, we're going to move forward. There it goes. If your children have sinned, and then he turns, it gets personal. Says, maybe it wasn't you. He says, if your children have sinned against you, because it's always helpful to criticize a hurting person's children, I've found. Just works really well. If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hands of their transgressions. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely he will rouse himself and he will restore you to rightful habitation. And though you begin with very small, the latter days will be very good. There's so much BS in that. It's Job. You know, those kids, they clearly got what they deserved. They were just clearly brats, and God struck them down. And here's the deal. If you get your head together, get your heart right, you get to God, he's going to come. He's going to restore you to a good place, and this is going to be better than it ever did. You know what? You know, God knows the plans for yes for you, plans to prosper you. You know, God won't let you endure more than you can handle. Tough times don't last. Tough people do. All the kinds of things we say to people in the midst of their grief that are proverbial things that may even have some truth to them, misapplied, misunderstood, superficially, where we're speaking comfort to our own souls, not even concerned about the other. Bildad goes on. I'm sorry, Zophar. Should a multitude of words go unanswered? This is the third friend. And a man full of talk be judged right? You're just a bunch of words, Job. Should your babble silence men? Actually, should be good. Just you should silence. Again, shut up. And when you mock, shall no one shame you? You know the value of shame. Here's the reason there's so much shame in our culture. We actually believe in shame. We actually believe in telling people shame on you. And I get it, because it gets a short-term result. It silences people, gets their head down, it gets them moving a little direction for a little bit. But it is a horrible motivator. It's a crushing way. It destroys identity. It's calling people down. It's not calling them up. It's shaming them about where they've been. It's not inspiring them where they're going. It's just a horrible way to teach people. And Zophar deeply believes in it. He goes on. For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clear in God's eyes. He never said that at all. He didn't stay and say, this is what I believe about God. This is the truth. I'm completely right about this. Job's response is basically this. I don't know what's going on. I don't even know who God is anymore. I don't know how he acts, because everything I thought is blown up. I just wonder what the heck's going on. That's pretty much Job. And for him to come back and say, your problem is theological. If you just understood the theology of this, okay, you'd understand. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips. God's gonna, and then and go, God's on our side. Okay, you know, God, oh man, God agrees with our theology. And that he would tell you the secret wisdom, just things you don't understand, secret wisdom. You know, there are sins you did. You probably did some sins. They say this in another place. You probably did some sins you weren't aware of, Job, you know, and it was a secret. And then God's going to show you, well, this is how you sin. You go, oh, okay, my bad. Sorry, thanks for taking everything and wiping everything out, okay? It's that kind of understanding. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt desires. So he comes back and says, and you know what? God's really good. He should have given you a lot worse than he gave you. When he stole all your wealth, killed all your kids, took everything, turned your wife to despair, you know, he should have done a whole lot more than that. There's so much wrong and abusive about this. And then there's a fourth friend, bonus friend, okay? And this guy is a guy by the name of Elihu. And if you really read Elihu, he just deepens all the arguments with greater certainty, with greater superficiality, with even more linear kind of logic of a theology. And the thing that is unique about him, many things, there's many lessons in here, but this is the one I want to bring out today, is that this is a guy who's young and angry. And listen, there's two problems with that. One is that your anger never serves you well. When you're living in anger, and understand that anger is almost always born from fear. And again, these guys were knocked off of their simplistic theology, and so now they're afraid, and because they're afraid, they get angry. That's a very typical response, okay? And so when you get angry, you go to a place of survival. And this literally is a neurochemical brain thing where parts of your brain quit working. What parts? Well, the parts that have problem solving, creativity, openness, compassion, empathy, and you start fighting. You start attacking. So when you're angry and you're not aware of you're angry and you don't have the spiritual and emotional awareness and maturity to admit you're afraid and you're angry, you're a little dangerous, okay? The other thing is he's young. Now, there's nothing wrong with being young. All of us, it happened to all of us. In fact, there's so much positive, powerful about it. But here's the thing about being young. There's a psychologist by the name of Piaget. He talked about developmental stages with kids. The one between like 17 and 22, he called the savior stage. Because he says it's at this part where young people have very little to risk, but they become aware of big ideals and big things. They can process metaphor now. They can see complicated things. And they look at the world and they say, why is it like this? All you guys who came before us really screwed this up. What's going on? And they became inflamed with justice. And listen, friends, it is beautiful. It is powerful. There have been times where God has used it to change things wonderfully. But listen, understand, when you don't have with that experience, both experience about the way the world actually is and experience about the things we only learn from suffering ourselves, you can become very certain about very simple things, very complicated things in a very simple way. And listen, we are currently living in a culture that has a ton of influence by the young and the angry. And there's some of it that's good, that's calling for reform and valuable, and we need to give voice to it. But it needs to be moderated with wisdom, the wisdom of life and experience. This is where the Bible talks so much about the wisdom of the elders, the wisdom of the ones. That's what the Bible says in the church. You should not put a novice or a young person in too much of a position of authority, because there's just things that you only learn through time and experience. And so there's a word of wisdom in this. So watch how this guy is described in the scriptures. Then Elihu, the son of Barak, the Buzite, again, family names, of the family of Ram, burned with anger. So this dude is watching this, and he's getting madder and madder and madder. Why? Because the way they're treating Job? No, not so much. He burned with anger at Job, because in his thinking, Job was justifying himself rather than God. Job had too small a view of God. God, he was making God too little. He wasn't having enough faith. He kept saying that he's done no wrong. And if he didn't do wrong, and wrong comes only when people do wrong, that means God's wrong, and that's not acceptable. So if God's wrong, then Job, you know, can't be wrong, and I can't handle that theology. And so he's getting afraid, and so he's getting angry. One of the things that's common when we're young is we can find something we believe, just one thing, and it hasn't been challenged by all the other things, and we become very certain of it. Very certain of it. And we haven't learned the wisdom of listening, of learning, of adapting, of having what we believe challenged in a healthy way, free marketplace of ideas, all those kinds of things. He's angry. Okay, now watch this. He goes on. He burned with anger also at Job's three friends because they had found no answer, although they had declared Job to be in the wrong. So he's mad at everybody. He's mad at the people who know the thing, didn't fix the thing, and they got the thing together. And thank goodness I'm here. Thank goodness I'm here to set this thing right. Now watch this. Now Elihu had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouths of these men, he burned with anger. Third time it says this dude's angry. Okay, angry friends are not good. That's all we're gonna say. If you read about the rest of Elihu, you're gonna see that he basically repeats the argument. He just makes it a lot more personal that not only has this happened to Job, not only is it, you know, Job's fault, Job deserves what he got, okay? This is just, because any other solution would mean what I believe about God is wrong and I can't handle that. See, when you're knocked off your certainty, all you're left with is faith. All you're left with is faith. See, here's one of the big lessons of Job. We think what we want is answers. And so we ask these questions, and it's so important to ask the questions. It's so important to express the fear, the doubt, the anxiety, the questions, the inconsistencies. We think we want answers. In other parts of the Bible, in other parts of theology, there's answers for some of it. There's a whole lot of mystery still. Problem of evil is a problem, okay? It's all there. We think we want answers, but what we really want is God. And there are parts of God that we can only experience. There are parts of humanity, there are parts of community we can only experience through the crucible of the dark hour of the soul, of loss, of bitterness, of fear, of those things that challenge us to our very core. And if we would have the faith to meet God in the lament, in the complaint, if we'd find friends who are safe, who will just sit in the ashen for day after day and live the presence of God and sharing our pain, then we reach the point where we can ask the question in a calmer frame of mind. You know, you're being a good friend, not when you feel like it's time to say what you think you need to say, but when you don't say anything and the person comes and asks, and they're ready to ask. Or maybe you understand that maybe my role, even if I know the right answer they need, is not to give them their right answer, but to be and to pray with them and for them. And then God's going to bring the answer over there. This is a big lesson, parents. So many of the important things in life, particularly when our kids are young, they cannot receive from us. Stakes are just too high. They care too much about our opinion. It's just too risky. And so God brings other people in their life, and they'll say something you've been saying, and it'll frustrate you. I've been saying that. And they think this person's so wise. I'm wise! You know, that kind of thing. Okay? That's about you, not about them. Okay? But for us to come back as people of faith and say, God, I'm going to question, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to lament, but at the same time, God, I'm going to trust that at the end of the day, you are good, you've got a plan, you do love me, I don't get it. I don't get it. And when I see someone, I'm going to have the courage to get close to them and stay with them as long as you have me stay with them. And I'm not going to get impatient. I'm not going to throw answers. I'm not going to vomit my opinion. I'm not going to crawl up on the island of their experience and act like I own that or understand that or I feel that, like that, feel that. It may be similar to mine, but I sure am not going to, the minute they start talking, say, well, let me tell you about my deal and let me put that on your island. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. See, here's the problem with a message when you're in like this. You all are waiting for the 10 things good friends do. What are the rules here? So I can do those and then move on to what I really want to do. What are the loopholes? What are the rules? It doesn't work like that. This is wisdom. Wisdom says, okay, what are the principles guiding me here, God? Patience, empathy, you know? And then how do I apply it with this friend and this situation and my situation? And how to become a more self-aware, emotionally healthy person who understands the deeper aspects of faith, more profound theology, who understands just my own story, my own struggle, so that I am aware, so that I can be a safe person for people who are hurting to be with. that I'll get rid of this Messiah complex I have, where I feel like I need to have all the answers, this incredible pressure to be the wise one, the image that I've created in my own mind, or to be the person who can fix it or help or make it go away by buying something or saying something or doing something, where maybe the calling is for me to just sit in the mess with them. Ugh. I mean, I got to feel this for this long? Well, that's what friendship looks like. You know, again, several years ago, I went through that incredibly dark hour of the soul in my life where there it just felt like darkness was there, and it was a season. It was like over a year, and I just hit a wall. It was a lot of things. It was things that happened to me. It was things that I'd done. It was unhealthy patterns, but I was broken. And there were a lot of people in my life who knew me, loved me, had friends, but I'd gotten isolated because I was pastor of the church. And I kind of just, it was an isolated thing. I was on this island, and some of the people I thought maybe God would send, they had other roles and they couldn't come. But God sent three friends to me. Three men who, honestly, before this, I barely knew these guys. And I don't know what it was, but a lot of people texted me, a lot of people called me, a lot of people said, hey, I'm there, you know, give me a call, if you need anything. But just the way these guys did it just made it feel safe. And I tell you what, these guys just, they didn't give me advice, but they helped me, they gave to me. We took drives. One guy, we could drive for hours and not say anything, and I just needed that. And we ate more pie at Norsky Nook than anybody should eat in a lifetime. I mean, and we talked about something and nothing, and there were times I didn't want to see them, times I saw them. They just took that. I said crazy, horrible, off-the-wall things about people, about God. My perspective was so skewed. I was just broken, and they were just there. And I tell you what, that's what friendship looked like for me. And not only that, I had an incredibly supportive board, incredibly loving church, incredibly patient people, and all of that pastored me, shepherded me, and made me a better shepherd. And so this challenge of figuring out what it looks like to not only go through these times, but to be the kind of person that is truly, truly safe, that is not so dealing with their own stuff that they think they're helping other people, but they're really dealing with their own stuff and they're not aware of it. But to be the kind of person who is truly helpful, who is truly present, who truly shares in that journey, who will sit on the ash heap of a person's life and rip their clothes and cry their eyes out and just sit in silence for a day and a night and a day and a night and a day and a night and beyond. Man, that's the challenge. That's what community looks like. That's where humanity is discovered. And I think that's where in the community of suffering we find God. Let's pray together. Father, I thank you. Thank you for the book of Job. I think it's real, it's honest, it's wise. Help us to just get a hold of the wisdom of this book and teach each one of us to apply it in wherever we're at. Whether we're grieving about the pain in this world that's just overwhelming us, the fears we have about our nation, our world, and wars and rumors of wars, whether it be someone we love who's going through something, we don't know what to do, there's nothing we can do, there's nothing we can say, how do we just be there and be a friend? Or whether it's just us, and we are in that dark hour of the soul, and we are overwhelmed and we're afraid, give us the courage to find safe people and safe places to feel it, express it. Give us the ability to lament, to complain, to trust that we can do all that, we can say all that, we can even say wrong things, and you're never gonna come to us and say, shame on you, do better. You're just gonna be there, and we're gonna maybe not even find the answers to our questions, but we're gonna find more of you. That's what our heart wants, that's what our soul wants. And so we just lift these things up, we come to you, we cry to you, and we thank you. And we lift all this up in Jesus' name, amen.